Hello, welcome to the ASI podcast series, the research podcast series. I am Richard Earhart. I'm guest host, filling in for Dr. Jake Thorne for the Research Update podcast. And we're going to talk today about a special topic that's pretty common in many parts of the world, but less so in the United States, and that's called pasture lambing. So I've got a special guest, Mr. Isaac Matchett from Matchett Farms in Charlevoix, Michigan, who's got a lot of experience with this practice and has been very successful. So he's going to give us a lot of great information. I myself have had the opportunity to do this also. So I've got some background. I was exposed to it in New Zealand in the 1980s, and I got to see its potential there. And then when I started my own sheep farm about 25 years ago, I employed it as well. But Isaac certainly has much more experience with it. So welcome to the podcast, Isaac.
Thank you, Dr. Earhart. And thank you to ASI for the invitation to participate. My family's owned sheep, 50 to 100 head since the mid-1950s. And as my brother Noah and I came back to the farm a little over 15 years ago, we recognized for this to be a full-time enterprise for my father, Tim, Noah, and myself, we would need to grow our flock significantly. And this 2024 season, we plan to lamb 1,700 ewes. We are a forage-based operation. Given our we're located in northern Michigan, so give the northern part of the Lower Peninsula. So given our northern geographical location, we're able to run an intensive grazing program for about 6 months of the year, and we rely on stored feed for the winter months.
Oh, I was just going to mention, I've had a chance to watch your growth. I remember back when I first started my appointment here at Michigan State University as a small ruminant specialist. You actually, Isaac, were the very first person to call me. I don't know if you realize that. You called me, I think it was the day after I accepted the position, and you talked to me when I was still in New York State.
Yeah, I knew that we were able to connect early on. I didn't realize that I brought your first challenge to the table from Michigan, but I guess glad to have made the acquaintance at this point. But
yeah, what I thought was interesting, then I visited your farm about 3 months later, and I drove up and I expected to meet not a teenager. Okay. You were a teenager then.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this is a serious young man with a lot of great questions. So that's where we started. Yeah.
Yeah. So essentially from that time when we met, do you know what year that was, Richard, roughly?
2008.
Yeah. So I finished school in 07. So we'd have been about a year into that growth. Yeah, as we needed to grow, we viewed pasture lambing as an opportunity to best use our labor and our monetary resources. And as we consider that topic today, I wanted to also make mention of the fact that the term pasture can mean a lot of different things across the USA. And just to provide some context of where my perspective comes from, or where our experiences are, our pastures are all on tillable farmland, which allows us to fertilize, reseed, maintain, and make improved pastures, so to speak. But I believe that pasture lambing can be a tool that works in a lot of different scenarios, in a lot of different pasture type environments across the country.
Sure. Sure thing. I think it is pretty adaptable to a lot of situations, but it's really good to understand that you are on improved pastures, and we'll talk specifically about some of those pastures as we move along here. So why don't you tell me what kind of sheep you're raising now on these fairly high productivity pastures, and how many people are involved in lambing your 1,700 ewes?
Yeah, that's fair. So we've got a flock of polypay ewes, high health status ewes they're very productive. We graze between 300 and 350 acres through the summer months, so about 6 months of the year, for those 1,700 ewes and their lambs during lactation. In terms of labor at lambing time, I would view our system to require one person per 500 ewes. And I say that with an asterisk just because I believe the labor required to lamb ewes is really highly a function of drop rate. So if you're this one person per 500 ewes, I'm going to assume a 200% drop rate in approximate terms.
Yeah, that those are highly productive sheep. And that's certainly, I don't think, now when I first started pasture lamb, was exposed to it in New Zealand in the 80s, I think those ewes were mostly Romney ewes. They were lambing at 130% tops, I would say. So what you're doing is pretty exceptional in my view, because you're lambing ewes that are dropping 200% on pasture, and that requires a more high order level of management, which we're going to be talking about. So the other thing I was wondering about, can you describe really what your infrastructure, because what this has done is it allowed you to expand without a lot of buildings and so forth. So do you have a lambing barn, or what sort of infrastructure do you have for your 1700 ewes?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that was really, you know, as we needed to grow, that was really the key thing that stuck out about the opportunity to pasture lamb. Is it basically significantly reduced our need for infrastructure investment, like equipment, facilities, and it let us channel that cash flow, if you will, that otherwise would have had to been spent on building or equipment, towards retaining a high percentage of our ewe lambs. You know, we've got a couple ATVs and a trailer that we pull with those ATVs to help facilitate the efficient movement of, you know, lambs or ewes with their babies across the farm or to a different pen if needed. But really, other than that and fencing, which we have a lot of fencing and water line, those were and all relatively at a low cost compared to, you know, actual concrete. And
sure. So I can definitely see that's how you were able to expand by retaining ewe lambs and being able to, you know, kind of invest your money in your sheep. So given this is probably a new procedure for a lot of sheep producers in the United States, can you give me an overview of the methods you've used, kind of a higher level overview, and then maybe talk a little, first of all, talk about what you started doing and maybe what you're doing now and how they differ a little bit.
Yeah. So we initially started with a system that I would call drift lambing, which basically those ewes move every 24 hours. And we've moved now to set stocking. So I guess to expand on both of those, so we got drift lambing, which we started with, and we've moved to set stocking, which is our current method. And we've employed that method, set stock lambing, for a little over 10 years, I believe. But to expand on those two systems in themselves a little bit, drift lambing, the ewes are, you know, they're about to lamb or they're lambing as in a fairly large group on pasture. And every 24 hours or so, you would essentially open the gate and the ewes that have not lambed will move on. And those that have lambed in the past 24 hours are bonded to their lambs well and essentially immobile. Those lambs aren't ready to move, and mom's not going to move without her lambs, and they'll just kind of hang back. And over time, you move a group of ewes that has not lambed forward day after day after day, and the ewes with lambs have hung back and sifted themselves out, and you start to begin to accumulate a group of ewes with lambs.
It's interesting, if I might just add something there. So when I have given clinics and tried to talk about pasture lambing, most new producers find that a crazy notion, that the sheep are going to hold back with their lambs and not drift forward every time you open the gate. So are there any special considerations, like leaving enough pasture behind, things like that, that help, you know, prevent problems with this drifting?
Yeah, that's a very good point. You need to have lots of pasture. Essentially, if that ewe has all the food she wants, if she has access to all the food she wants in a pretty close proximity to where her lambs are, she has no reason to leave. And also, you know, if we're going to do that, I probably wouldn't go through the pen and, you know, stir them all up as much as I could. I'd kind of walk in quietly, these ewes will train. They'll come to recognize what's going on, and you open the gate and maybe slightly get their attention, and they'll, those that don't have lambs are like, yeah, great, we'll go for a walk, and those with lambs are gonna, they're gonna hang back.
Okay. Yeah, that's that. It is amazing. And it really does work. I do that exact system myself. And it's just all about how not to get the ewes too riled up when you move them. So the just the ones that haven't given birth yet move on. But so you've not, now you're explaining that you've evolved to the set stocking system. Can you tell us about that and why you chose that as you move along?
Yeah. So set stocking, essentially we place those ewes in these lambing pastures or paddocks for about 19 to 21 days. It's key that we have a very tight lambing window for this system to work. So they're going to be clear, these ewes are going to, a couple days before lambing, they're going to go into these lambing paddocks, and they're going to stay there essentially the whole first heat cycle. And use some of the, so a couple, I guess, major reasons. It's pretty labor efficient, and it, all of our time during lambing with a set stock system is focused on ewe and lamb care and whatever needs to happen accordingly there, as opposed to maybe some time sensitive movements of groups where with drift lambing. So that's one, just the generalized focus. But I think bigger than that, and maybe that I'd like to highlight, is the ewe behavior in those pastures. So once you get them in there for a couple days, they get very comfortable with their surroundings. Once they're comfortable, they're not restless. They just kind of spread out and relax. One kind of nuanced difference I noticed between drift lambing and set stock lambing is some of those ewes learn to move every day with drift lambing, and it is their expectation that they're going to move. Where set stocking, those ewes have no thought that they're going anywhere, so they're just hanging out, they're spread out, they're comfortable, and I think that has this spread out and comfortable, relaxed with no expectation of moving, has a big impact on the ewes' ability to bond. I think it helps lamb bonding. Ewe to lamb bonding. There's time, and the ewes in no hurry to get anywhere.
That makes a whole lot of sense. And it sounds, the other thing that I think you've brought up a little bit here is that your labor is really focused on taking care of these sheep and not moving fences or moving sheep so much. So there's an advantage on in terms of scale maybe for you as well. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. At a large, if you're trying to, so we're going to lamb, I think there's 1,130 ewes scanned pregnant for the spring lambing, and we're going to lamb those essentially with a little over two people, and we just we want that time and effort to be focused on those ewes and those lambs. And so lambing is a pretty time sensitive thing. Being there at the right, in the right place at the right time is the difference sometimes to that ewe and to that lamb, and we just want to make sure that we're available for that.
So you mentioned you have a concentrated lambing period. It's lasting about 21 days. So these sheep are getting bred in December for this May lambing period. And what one of the important things, it seems, is determining the stocking rate or the number of ewes per acre for such a system. And I'm sure there's a lot of factors you've thought about that contribute to this. Can you give me just kind of an overview of the factors that determine your stocking rate and kind of how that varies, X to Y ewes per acre, and why you might choose a different stocking rate?
Yes, certainly. So it's based on pasture growth rate, like how fast is it currently growing and kind of current forage mass at the time of lambing. And those things are, you know, growth rate and the amount of forage that is there, if you will, are somewhat seasonally dependent. So it depends whether it's spring or fall. And then it's also going to be a function of that pasture's fertility, the species of forage, grass, legume, whatever it may be. You know, forage that's too short, and we've kind of touched on it, those ewes are going to, they're going to lamb, and they're going to need to seek food, and they're going to travel too much too soon for those lambs to keep up and to allow enough bonding time in nursing. And forage too tall will, the ewe's got lots of food, but it limits the line of sight visual for ewe to lamb, which is a key component for bonding in that first, 24, 48 hours. So yeah, circling back to stocking rate, in the end, it varies from 5 to 15 ewes per acre in the spring.
Okay.
5 ewes the acre is going to be an unimproved pasture, and 15 ewes the acre is going to be highly improved. So, springtime, those are benchmark numbers. Fall lambing, it ends up more around 8 ewes per acre. We're reliant on a lot of times stockpiled forage as opposed to grass that's currently growing.
Okay. So just to get that clear then, Isaac, you're saying you have two periods that you lamb on pasture. One's in May and one's starting late summer, early fall, right?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. So we lamb May, start a lambing period that starts May 25th, and we have a lambing period that starts August 25th. And in our region, the grass grows very differently in late May than it does in late August. And we try to match our lambing period with that forage resource, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. So when you're in the spring period, you have this explosive forage growth. You're lambing 2/3 of your ewe flock, it sounds like. And then in the fall, this pasture growth is slowing down. To utilize that resource effectively, you're not going to have it quite as big of a group. And in fact, it sounds like some of the forage is even stockpiled because it's growing pretty slow during late August and September in northern Michigan.
Correct. And yeah. I think, yeah, so we do. We have those groups split about 2/3 spring, 1/3 fall. And I think a key component that's all, when I get asked about that, that's often overlooked is because of the spring flush of grass, because of winter moisture and essentially the reset of winter, the amount and timing of forage that we will have available in the spring is a much safer assumption, much surer bet, if you will, than our fall forage, which is essentially a function of how much moisture we got in July and August. And, we have no idea what the weather's going to provide. So essentially, we kind of know, we lamb a larger group in the spring because we kind of know or have a lot better feeling for how much forage we will have available and when, as opposed to the fall, we may need a lot of acres to get that, that need met.
Sure. I think, perhaps Mother Nature in our climate here in northern United States kind of ensures generally enough winter moisture for May and June, but the rest is kind of a little hit or miss depending on the season. So that's important to know. Yeah.
It's a risk management tool, I guess, to spread that out.
Sure. And so you are having lambs available to market at different times of year. I'm sure that's another nice
There's several reasons we do that. Yes, it's just there's, logically speaking, you might split that group half and half, spring and fall, but it's pretty hard to guarantee the forage for fall. So we leave it shifted, weighted in spring.
So one issue that, people are going to ask, and I know I did, is what are some of the keys to prevent mismothering and pasture lambing? I mean, the idea of leaving control of bonding entirely to the ewe and letting her natural instincts determine that is a lot to let go of for some shepherds. So what do you do? What are some of the keys to prevent mismothering and to ensure good bonding?
Yeah. So, and that's, we touched on a little bit, the ewes being comfortable in their pens and spread out and calm are kind of That's the building block of it. So, and how do we accomplish that? I think you're looking at two things. One, so obviously we're observing or looking at, we're watching these lambs and we're assessing, we're trying to evaluate bonding success, if you will, based on if the lambs have nursed, does the ewe attend to her lambs? And I mean her lambs, not whatever lambs walking by, but is she keeping track of her lambs and other lambs and ewes away? And then part of that's on the lamb. Like, how well does that lamb follow its mother? It's a two-way bond there. And so those are kind of how we're gauging that. Mm-hmm. And then in instances where that's a problem or ways that we try to promote that, I think, you know, in an instance where it's a problem, you know, if a ewe is just too tight or too near other ewes or other, you know, high traffic area where other lambs are, we'll move that ewe away. A lot of times she will follow her lambs, or we could, you know, slide her into that cart we keep behind the ATV, and we'll just move her to a corner of the pasture that there's no sheep and she's away from other traffic, which usually helps. And I think the other thing that's very important is obviously we're checking these sheep as they lamb. We need to minimize the disturbance when we go in the pen. And ways that we do that is, as we've mentioned, we check with an ATV. And the ewes they'll become accustomed to that. And they will let us pass very close by so that we can see, you know, if she's not lambed, we can evaluate for, you know, is she good? Does she need help? If she has lambs, we can usually get close enough to see from the ATV whether those lambs are fed or not fed. And basically, when you're on that ATV, you are outside of their flight zone, and so they let you get close and just kind of pass by. I think a conscious or strategic movement through the pen when you enter is important. Like, I always, when I pull up to a pen, I look at the whole pen and I think, all right, where are all the sheep? And when I enter, where are they going to want to go? Like, are there places that I know every time they like to run to this ridge? Obviously, ewes that are spread out, if they're pressured, they're going to run to the flock. So just try to be very strategic about your movement through the pen to try and keep ewes spread out, keep them calm, stir. Don't apply pressure to the group that's going to make them group. Yep. Don't apply pressure in a way that's going to make them group up, pass through the middle that might make them spread out a little bit. So the goal is to minimize ewe movement. And we've also stopped tagging and banding at birth in an effort to it's a bit of a not that it's imperative, but it's a bit of a distraction in a lot of cases for ewe and lamb that's maybe not necessary. And so we've left that we've stopped doing that to essentially to try and seal the deal on the bond.
I see. So kind of a take home for audiences, it sounds like what you're saying is you're minimizing disturbance by thinking hard about your actions in a pasture, yet you need to have good observation of these animals to be able to figure out how the bonding's working. So sounds like, you know, that becomes a true skill to acquire to be successful with this, and maybe takes a little bit of experience, right, to get that figured out.
Yeah. I think you've summarized that well. Yes.
So it sounds like to minimize, you know, big issues, you're going to have to take some lambs off the pasture, I would imagine. What signs do you look for, and how do you determine which lambs you might need to take off pasture and possibly rear artificially?
Yeah, essentially that's a question if the lamb is fed or not. So as we monitor, as we try to, you know, quietly pass through these pastures, and we're evaluating whether or not the lambs are fed. So the question is if the lamb has been fed by its mother, and if not, does mom have milk? So is this an issue? Does mom not have milk? The question is, does mom not have milk, or is the lamb not figured out how to nurse? Somewhat either way, we'll feed them with a stomach tube once. We'll mark the lamb. Obviously, if mom doesn't have milk, we'll take the lamb in artificially and artificially raise it. But if it does, if mom has milk, we'll feed it via stomach tube, mark the lamb. And if he shows up or she shows up hungry again, we'll bring it in and raise artificially. When you look at a set of lambs and their mother, the udder conformation, teat placement, size, and shape are they're extraordinarily important in a pasture lambing system. Those lambs need to be able to plug in to nurse on their own. And that udder and teat shape can have a huge impact on it. So if we see an udder that maybe we feel might be hard for lambs to start, we maybe take special note or pay us, you know, special attention that those lambs have been fed. And then in general, the mother's attentiveness. If you've got a lamb that's she's not paying any attention to, it's likely going to be a challenge for him to keep up and to nurse. Number of lambs in the litter are another factor we evaluate. Triplets, we let the ewes raise their triplets. If one is hungry, we will take it in. If they've all been fed, they stay. We'll select which lambs come in based on the size. You know, we want to leave even-sized lambs with even suckle drive on mom so that they compete well for milk.
Okay. I remember when I first learned about pasture lambing, thinking back, I think I was in college, and they were doing at the University of Wisconsin where I went to school at the Spooner Research Station, and they'd switched to this system. And I remember the shepherd told us the first thing he did when he went from barn lambing to pasture lambing was he had to cull a lot of ewes for misshapen udders, and that became like a really important factor. And it sounds like you've kind of underscored the importance of that as well.
It's maybe the number one factor. I mean, if those lambs can't start on their own, you've got to somehow catch that ewe and plug them in. I mean, it'd be a shame to have that ewe and with the capacity to milk, but not have her raise her lambs.
Sure.
That's key.
So thinking of a few other concerns, I guess, with pasture lambing that, the outside person looking in would be wondering about is, when you're doing pasture, when you're lambing in a barn or in a shed, you can catch a ewe pretty easily or relatively easily and manage a difficult birth or dystocia. How does that work on pasture? How do you manage those situations?
Yeah, that's completely fair. And it's a legitimate issue and challenge. I will say on pasture, these ewes are extremely fit. So, they get lots of exercise. I think that may limit some of the dystocia that you experience, but it definitely does not get rid of all of it, especially when you've got ewes having, prolific ewes that are having a lot of multiple births. There's always going to be that challenge. And, you monitor closely, and those that need help need to be caught and assisted in whatever way that, whatever assistance they need.
How do you catch them exactly?
So catching is, I prefer a leg crook. As I know, the traditional shepherd staff is a neck crook, but there is only one neck, and it is always going away from me. So I figure my chances are four times as good to go for a leg crook. So I use a leg crook. I'll use whatever tactical advantage I can find. If that ewe is attracted to lambs, even if she hasn't had any, I'll use a lamb to try and to decoy her. A lot of late pregnant ewes aren't necessarily moving that fast, especially if she's in distress lambing. But a lot of times, if you can work that ewe along a fence or to the kind of a corner of a pen and limit her options, you're able to get her caught. And one handy trick that I find is I carry a halter in my back pocket all the time. And if I catch that ewe maybe away from my supplies, I can hobble her for a few minutes to walk back to get gloves or whatever equipment I may need to help her.
That makes great sense. I've noticed myself, because I do a pasture lambing, I do an accelerated production system, and one of my lambings each year is on pasture. So the same ewes, they alternate between barn lambing and shed lambing. So it's basically the same sheep. I definitely have fewer dystocias on pasture than I do in the barn. And I can only, speculate, but I think it has a lot to do with what you said is fitness and sort of exercise, and it's real interesting. So tell us just a little bit about your production of your sheep in terms of what is their drop rate? How many lambs does each ewe tend to have? And if you're willing to share, can you tell us a little bit about your mortality and artificial rearing? Like what percent of lambs, do you lose? And
yeah,
you end up rearing.
That's all fair. So on average, and this would include replacements. So this is all data lumped together. Our drop is 195%. So this is replacements and mature use. And at weaning, our death loss will be 12.5%. And we artificially rear about 15% of the lambs born. If asked, I would tell you that about half of that 15% probably would have been okay on mom, and the other half would have probably died. They'd be in that death loss number. The hard part is you have to, you know, you see these ewes and lambs once every 24 hours, and you have to make a decision in about 30 seconds as to whether that lamb is good to go for the next 24 hours, or if he might be compromised, or, you know, he may be alive the next time you're back, but may, sure, you know, maybe not going to thrive at that point. So we tend to err on the side of pulling extra lambs in for the sake of their well-being.
So it sounds like if I did the quick math in my head, you're ending up with, you know, 170%, 1.7 lambs per ewe weaned, and some of those are artificially reared, but that's pretty exceptional in a pasture environment. So you mentioned we talked about the times of year. You said you choose late May, late August. How specific are those times in terms of, like, why do you choose those times? What are some of the factors, and how important is it to keep it tight to those times?
Yeah. But the timing of that is, I mean, we could maybe shift it 5 days one way or the other, but that's pretty, to try and match the outdoor temperatures and risk of cold rains and hot and maybe heat stress that's too much for the ewes, to try and match that along with forage quantity, quality, essentially the availability of forage. Those are pretty specific times, and they would be different farm to farm. You know, they would be the same for another farm in my geographical location, but if you went a couple hundred miles south or west or east or any direction, it would be slightly different for that farm because of their climate. So those times are very specific, and basically we are trying to match or trying to lower the risk of cold rains in lamb before and after the risk of intense summer heat.
Sure. So how often do you have one of these difficult evenings in your
opinion? Yeah.
And what kind of things can you do to kind of reduce the problem with a cold rain less than 60 degrees unexpectedly in May?
Yeah, I think that is, it's not more, it's a one, I view it as a one in every 5 year problem.
Okay.
We don't actually see it quite that often, but I would not be, you take in spring and fall, I wouldn't be surprised if you encountered something like that. And then, so in extreme conditions, we will set rows of round bales, straw, hay, whatever, you know, whatever you have in the pastures as a windbreak. We will move newborn lambs and their mothers to those rows of straw to get the lambs out of the wind and a little drier. So basically that lamb's going to burn a lot of calories in those conditions to survive. Mm-hmm. And he or she has a very limited amount of time to nurse. So we'll feed basically any lambs that haven't already eaten when we're checking or moving them. But we'll leave with mom. We would, if we've got, you know, a weak set of lambs, we'd pull them indoors, you know, just in an emergency scenario to kind of give them a little more time. And we would probably in those scenarios are definitely, we're pulling all the triplets. We're leaving only two lambs per ewe on pasture with mom, just to reduce the risk, you know, let two lambs get as much milk as they can from mom. We're just trying to increase the survival rate of those two lambs and reduce the risk for the third.
So you're just saying, like, for those newborns that are happening at that time, that's where your focus, like the ones that are at greater risk, that are triplets, ones that haven't fed yet, you're either feeding with a stomach tube or you're bringing them in just as an emergency situation, right?
That is correct.
That's okay. Correct. Yes. All right. So then getting back to your system, so you've got these sheep set stock. They're sitting in these groups for that entire lambing period, 21 some days. When do you dock tails and tag lambs? And then maybe when do you first start gathering them up, or what's your next step?
Yeah, so they've lambed for 21 days. We will go through and sift. Obviously, there's a few ewes in that second heat cycle that haven't lambed. We'll go through and sift those out just so that we can get get those groups moving on those pastures. We can kind of, you're down to just a handful of ewes left to lamb. We can concentrate that checking. So that's done. And now we've got, we need to tag and band these lambs. That'll be at like 30 days of age, between 30 and 40 days of age is when that's done. And to accomplish that, we have, we'll walk them to a permanent handling yard.
Okay, to, sure.
Well, they're 30, 40 days old, so we'll push them up to a mile without any trouble.
I see.
That's when we would do that process. And so at that time, the lambs are tagged and banded, they're dewormed, and the ewes are dewormed at that time as well.
I see. So that's your first handling position. And so you're only doing, you're pretty, it sounds really efficient. So you're gathering, doing the docking, banding, and your first health intervention, I guess, which is deworming. Why don't we skip to that? Not skip to that, but let's just talk about that a little bit, because that is a big issue in our environment. We've got, you know, gastrointestinal nematodes, Homuncus contortuses are public enemy number one in our hot fest, growing season here, and so that becomes a real focus, especially when we get in July, which is what you're talking about now, because this 30-day period's got to be late June, early July. Tell us,
you spent a lot of 4th of July's docking lambs. Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds like it. That's very patriotic of you.
It's a good time. Yeah.
So tell us about just a little bit about an overview of your parasite management program. So you said you deworm once. When do you treat all the sheep at turnout? Do you have a targeted strategy in this system? Can you just give us a picture of that, please?
Yeah. Yeah. We aren't, as you've made clear, parasites and staying ahead of the parasites are kind of a key to the success of this, especially when you've got ewes trying to lactate on grass. At turnout, ewes that have been wintered outdoors would be dewormed. And this is we're turning out approximately 10 days before we lamb. So that time we deworm at turnout, it's just a little bit before lambing. That timing all works pretty good. However, we would not deworm all the ewes. We would leave about a 20% refugia population of ewes. So we would have the ewes in a chute. We'd identify those that are in very good body condition. We would FAMACHA score them to identify more so or more definitively those ewes that are not experiencing, to the best of our knowledge, a parasite challenge. And we would mark those ewes as refugia ewes for that deworming period.
Okay.
And then again, those ewes would be dewormed at 30 days, and then the next handling time would be at between 60 and 70 days at weaning, and they would be dewormed again. We do use copper oxide wire boluses along with, you know, three different deworming products all at the same time.
From three different chemical classes, it sounds like.
Yeah. So
it's a combination drench using some copper as an aided control. And that sounds like you're getting a very effective deworming, but you're careful to still use that combination treatment very strategically to help slow the rate of dewormer resistance, it sounds like.
Correct. Yeah, we have a pretty limited number of tools in our toolbox. So we're trying to do our best to, and those ewes that we're leaving as refugia ewes are, they're perfectly capable of tolerating it. We're not getting into trouble with that. We're conscious about which ones are selected, but
sure.
At this point, I'm happy with our parasite control. I believe we're controlling parasites in a way it's not having a negative impact on the productivity of these ewes and their lambs.
So yeah, that's a big achievement. So they're also, just digress slightly, you also have some issues with your stocking rate of, sort of getting close in the 5 to 10 ewe per acre rate. You're going to have some problems with coccidiosis too, I imagine. So what do you do to manage that?
Yes. So our management strategy on that is with coccidia is preventative, and a couple different things. So 3 weeks, 3 weeks before lambing, we will put decox in the TM, in the trace mineral salt that the sheep have on pasture, to limit the amount of coccidia that's in their environment or that the lambs will experience. So decox in the salt 3 weeks before lambing. that will stay in the salt all, you know, as long as the lambs are with the ewes, that will be in the salt. And then when the lambs are weaned, they will get an amprolium treatment on day 4 post-weaning, per label of the full 5-day treatment of the amprolium. And then those lambs will, again, have decox in their TMR for until 30 days post-weaning.
Okay.
And we're able to control, essentially reduce the amount, the prevalence of coccidia by doing that.
Yeah, that sounds like an important aspect of this for sure. Another concern people are always going to have, we talked about two of the bad peas here. One of them is parasites. The other, I reckon most producers would understand, is predation issues. What do you do to manage that? I mean, you would seem to be exposed having a bunch of ewes lambing on pasture. How does that work in your area, Isaac?
Yeah, we have a high surface area of exposure, especially if you saw our countryside. But primary predators that we would consider here are coyotes and eagles. You're pretty limited on what you can do with eagles. They come in from the sky. They're protected. They typically are going to eat a stillborn lamb or something like that. They will kill, you know, around 5 lambs a year. And that is a shame, but there's not, with the value of 5 lambs, there's not a lot we can do in terms of further prevention than to accept that for what it is. Coyotes, on the other hand, we've got a fairly extensive effort into fencing, and that's really, you know, there's some hunting pressure and trapping and that sort of thing, which definitely helps, but good fencing is really what we rely on to keep the coyotes out. We try to maintain a perimeter fence that's essentially a predator fence. And we're disciplined about keeping external gates closed. We're trying to prevent coyotes from developing bad habits, from being in the sheep areas and place, you know, we just don't want them comfortable in places they shouldn't be. And we've been blessed to have no documented losses. So
that's really interesting. Yeah. So as we move along, we consider this system. So at some point you're weaning these lambs. Can you tell us when you wean them and what those decisions are about? And then we'll talk a little bit more about some of the infrastructure and wrap this up.
Yeah. Yeah. So we wean at 60 to 70 days of age. At weaning, those lambs are moved into a confinement system, into a barn, and they're fed high energy diets, high concentrate diets. There's a few reasons for that. One is it provides the ewe recovery period. She's lactated for a couple lambs at least a lot of times on grass now. She's worked pretty hard. And so it allows her to recover, and it minimizes the ewe's risk of internal parasites. So it's a little bit of a strategy to manage against internal parasites. It also saves the pasture forage resources for the ewes, which is an adequate, I mean, that plain of nutrition that our pasture provides is plenty adequate to meet the needs of that ewe. And it allows us to give the lambs a higher plain of nutrition and essentially, you know, very effective cost to gain by feeding them in confinement. We deworm those lambs as they come into the barn, and we have, you know, they're clean of internal parasites. They don't get reinfected.
Sure. So they get a chance, if they do have a low-level infection or a moderate one, they heal pretty quickly.
Yeah, they're dewormed when they come in, and then they're fed well, they recover well. It also gets us positioned to have our females bred at 7 months of age, which is, there's time to make that happen, but you want those ewes to get in and get growing and get, you know, get prepared for that.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. So you're trying to get them to adequate body weight to get a good conception rate.
Correct.
At 7 months of age.
Yes.
So just to kind of summarize the equipment, one of the big things we've talked about, the relatively low investment, what are your tools that you need, and what are some of those investments you make?
Yeah. We rely heavily on an ATV for checking sheep, moving fences. And we also have an ATV trailer. It's a little custom-built cart, essentially, that that we carry electronets in. We can transport a ewe with her lamb safely. Just whatever needs to happen, we can rely on that. And in terms of other fencing, none of this would be possible without fencing. You know, the first fence we had was electronets, and then, you know, if I'm prioritizing these, so we need fencing, and we need watering, and we need handling equipment. And those, so the ATV, the fencing, the watering, and the handling equipment, I would say the ATV might be a little bit optional depending on size and scale of your operation. I mean, if you got a few ewes and you don't have to spread across a huge area, you can get away by doing that on foot. Mm-hmm. But the fencing you need, the watering you need, and you need a way to control, to handle those animals.
Sure.
Essentially, I find if you don't have a good handling system, a way to sort them, deworm, tag, whatever, safely, those management practices that are a little bit time sensitive maybe get done late, and it would come at a cost to the ewe or the lamb, you know, if you deworm late,
essentially. Sure. So if you were to try to sell this idea to some new producers or someone who's looking for maybe a change in their system, what advice would you give them for someone starting out with this system?
So there's been a lot of opportunity in pasture lambing for us. I think there's a lot of opportunity in pasture lambing for strategic management to have a very positive impact on the outcome of the lambing period. I would avoid, as you look at that, a lot of times pasture lambing gets just, you know, turn it out and see what happens approach or attitude towards it. And I would avoid that approach. I believe time and thought and some strategy going into that can be a big benefit. I'd give pretty careful consideration to the sheep's natural behavior. As you think about where you're going to lamb these ewes, and how that may look, I'd think about where are they comfortable. Try to avoid places and paddocks that have collection points. And I would just, you know, we've got lots of pastures. Well, never enough, but you've got different terrain in your pastures, if you know what I mean. And you've got shade trees, and you've got different lay of the land. And if you can pick areas to lamb that will encourage those ewes to spread out, that probably would give you the best opportunity for success. And then just general awareness of your forage resource, how that correlates to your typical temperature, and try to pick the right time. You know, try to pick the right time that gives you the best. They probably don't align perfectly. Like forage resource and temperature are probably not an exact match. So try and pick the right time that, you know, the happy medium there. That fits your farm.
I know my predecessor, Dr. Joe Rook, had mentioned to me that he thought pasture lambing should happen when the soil temperature is around 50 degrees in spring. And I think that may be something for people to think about if they're thinking about a spring temperature and kind of is it maybe a consideration there. So why don't we kind of wrap this up by summarizing what you would say are the pros and cons, Isaac, of pasture lambing?
I think the big one that you really can't deny or get around is it allows you to raise sheep with minimal infrastructure. And it doesn't matter how you look at that. If you can increase the margin on those lambs you raise because you pasture lamb them or you kept your overhead costs low, that's an opportunity. It also reduces labor. I know there's some that probably disagree with that, which is fine. But the ewes are feeding themselves and they're bedding themselves and they're walking to water. It's a minimal labor input. Challenges, you're subject to the variabilities of the weather, which we've discussed. It does at times require maybe slightly more skilled shepherding skills to identify when and how to intervene for hungry lambs or dystocia cases. There's obviously the risk of predation and internal parasites if you're comparing pasture lambing to, you know, a barn lambing system.
You bet. So I can see there certainly are some major labor savings possible with birth management. You have low infrastructure investment, But yeah, you need to manage your weather and mismothering risks and have a plan for pasture management and a good plan for predator and parasite control, which you've done a lot of thought on. So, boy, Isaac, I really appreciate having this great conversation with you and getting your advice and input on pasture lambing. And it's really nice that you've been able to share your time and experience with our audience.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, thanks again, Isaac. So to our audience out there, hopefully this episode's given you some new ideas to consider in your operation and things that you might want to adapt, maybe not pasture lambing, but just some of the ideas that Isaac's talked about. And so what I'd like to say in parting, as Jake always says, I encourage all of you to eat lamb and wear wool. And we'll have a next ASI research podcast next month. And look forward to having you tune in again for that. Thanks again. This is Richard Earhart, and I appreciate your participation in this podcast. Good day.